Good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Victoria Walsh. I'm Head of Public Programmes here at Tate Britain. Welcome to tonight's event, Museums for World Peace. This event is organised by the Institute of Ideas as a satellite event in the run-up to the weekend-long extravaganza Battle of Ideas, which will take place from the 31st of October to the 1st of November. And hopefully you may have all picked up the extraordinary catalogue of debates that will take place at the RCA over that weekend. For those of you not familiar with the Institute of Ideas, or indeed the Battle of Ideas, tonight's discussion certainly typifies the kind of inquiry into contemporary issues of culture and politics that the Institute has built its name on, as much as in the fields of science, education, technology and others. As director of the Institute, Claire Fox, who is chairing tonight's event, established it, in her own words, to create a public space where ideas can be contested without constraint. And I certainly hope tonight's event is also true of that. So my thanks go to both Claire and Tiffany Jenkins on the panel, who is Arts and Society Director of the Institute, who have co-produced tonight's event, and indeed to all speakers who accepted the invitation to take part. When Claire first approached me about this event at Tate Britain, we were actually displaying a major exhibition called Lure of the East, which some of you, if you're very diligent, may have noticed it being mentioned in passing by the Prime Minister back in 2007 in his War on Anti-Terrorism, in which he spoke about a number of cultural projects which the government were keen to support as taking projects forward to promote greater understanding of the contribution of Islam to European history and culture. So hopefully tonight's discussion will no doubt unpack some of the issues and assumptions and thinking behind that realignment of cultural diplomacy and the relationship with art. The discussion will be chaired by Claire, and if you don't recognise her, I'm sure some of you will also recognise her voice as a regular contributor to Radio 4's Moral Maze. But amongst other things, she is, apart from being extremely busy running the Institute of Ideas, regularly writes for newspapers, periodicals and journals. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Claire, who's going to introduce tonight's panel and take it from there. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Vicky. I'd just like to say it's been a great privilege working with Vicky and the team here at the Tate, and we were delighted to be able to put this event on. As Vicky said, it's Museums for World Peace, the Pros and Cons of Cultural Diplomacy. Just a little bit more on the Battle of Ideas, really just to give you kind of framework for tonight's discussion. We set up the Battle of Ideas Festival 5 years ago. Really, we were frustrated at the Institute of Ideas about the kind of stultifying intellectual atmosphere in the UK. Too many things we were told were taboos, too many things we were told we couldn't ask questions of. And we thought that the audience, a public audience, would be more intelligently challenging and challenged and want to have more interesting, irreverent and kind of quite stir-it-up type debates in the public sphere. And the way that we've organised the Battle of Ideas over those years is to work in partnership with people who have been prepared to work with us. The Institute of Ideas is something of a controversial and sometimes maverick organisation. So, it's really great that established institutions like Tate Britain are prepared to work with us. The Battle Satellite programme we started 2 years ago under the leadership of my colleague, Dr. Shirley Dent, who's sitting at the back. We wanted to expand the festival because over the course of one weekend at the Royal College of Art, which is what you've got the brochure for, we have 350 speakers, 75 debates and 2,000 attendees. And we just thought it was too big to make it get any bigger over the weekend. So we've extended it into the month of October in the run-up to it with standalone events, this being one of them. And the programme this year that Shirley's put together has been extraordinarily successful. This week, we're not only here, but we're discussing space as part of Sci-Fi London Festival at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich and political cartooning in an inoffensive age tomorrow night on the same night that the BNP are on Question Time. So we'll undoubtedly be discussing the pros and cons of free speech there. So do come along to other events as well. Issue of cultural diplomacy, we were particularly interested in the idea that the arts can play a decisive part in international relations through winning hearts and minds is something that's a kind of relatively new kid on the block of arts policy in this country, although some people have been involved in it for many years. I think probably it's been given a particular life post 9/11 discussions in relation to the Middle East are particularly informing it. But it's not something that's kind of very widely discussed or certainly debated in British cultural policy. It's just almost an assumed truism that's kind of come into being over the last few years. Everyone assumes it to be a good thing. And we'd rather like to interrogate that concept critically tonight, I think, and to kind of look at what it really means. A colleague and myself were in Berlin recently, and we went to visit the Institute of Cultural Diplomacy in Berlin. And they talked openly and proudly boasted of the fact that they were soft power, and that they were helping, using the arts to further the ends of international relations and peace and so on. And I realised that I hadn't heard the term soft power used quite so brazenly. They were unapologetic. So on the one hand, we want to critically examine this notion of cultural diplomacy. What does it really mean for the arts to be brought in as a part of international relations? Is it a good or a bad thing? And also, whether it's good, in fact, for international relations to have the arts acting as part of its soft power. So I'm going to introduce my panel. They're given a very strict 5 to 7 minutes, and after 6 minutes or so, I'll kind of just bang on the table slightly so that they get a sense that they've got a final minute. Yes, like at school. And then After that, we'll have a bit of a chat up here and a bit of a conversation, try and pull some of the threads together. But it's very much then over to you with a kind of conversation with the audience. We don't do it so that we have kind of strict question and answer. I'll take bundles of points or questions from the audience, then come back and get some reflections, and we'll have as much to-ing and fro-ing as we possibly can. Okay, let me introduce my panel. First of all, we have our host this evening, Dr. Stephen Deutscher, who's the director of Tate Britain, in fact, the founding director of Tate Britain, established in 2000. He himself is a specialist in 18th century art. He wrote a very interesting article in The Guardian in relation to the new interest in terms of the people in the West and in Britain in terms of Middle Eastern artefacts post 9/11 a few weeks ago. He's about to take over at the head of the Art Fund in the new year. Very exciting prospect, both for the Art Fund and for him, I'm sure. And so we're delighted that he's joining us. Next up to speak, we have Tim Stanley at the end there, who is Senior Curator of Middle Eastern Collections at the Victoria and Albert Museum, was previously the Deputy Curator of the Kalali Collection in London, has curated touring exhibition The Palace and the Mosque, has led the redevelopment of the Gallery on Islamic Middle East, now the Jamid Gallery of Islamic Art, and the lead curator for Asian ceramics in the new Ceramics Gallery, and is a practical example of where curating and this issue of cultural diplomacy come into being. We next have Andrea Rose sitting next to me, who's Director of Visual Arts at the British Council and has been since 1994. She's also the UK representative for UNESCO, UNESCO's Cultural Commission. And obviously the British Council has been at the forefront of leading cultural dialogue and ensuring that British artefacts and British arts are known about throughout the world, as well as bringing in to Britain many people and many artists from around the world. We then have Dr. Tiffany Jenkins is a sociologist, cultural commentator, as well as indeed my colleague, our own Arts and Society Director at the Institute of Ideas. Her academic research concentrates on the crisis of authority in the cultural sector and concerns cultural value and cultural property. I think she sees cultural diplomacy very much as part of the crisis of cultural authority, but more of that later. And her forthcoming book is Contesting Human Remains, Museums and the Crisis of Cultural Authority. And then finally, we have Jonathan Jones, who is so famous that he wouldn't sell his biography. So he writes on art for The Guardian, as we all know, and he's on the jury for the 2009 Turner Prize. And all I'd say is I always enjoyed reading his articles. Can we just give them all a very warm welcome, please? Okay, Stephen, your thoughts. Are you going to go to the...
As befits my status, I'm going to the lectern. And I've just realised, you know, it's the 21st of October, which a generation ago, everyone in this room would realise was Trafalgar Day. And in fact, in some places, somewhere this evening, probably naval establishments, dinners will be taking place and cultural relations, cultural diplomacy will be being pursued under a sort of veneer of forgive and forget. The old hostilities between England, Spain and France were being relived. I wanted to say, really, that at my in my time at Tate Britain, I've obviously spent a lot of time pursuing relationships with institutions and individuals far beyond the UK, and we all do that in national museums, although often I think we do it without really and understanding why. Sometimes there's an economic motive. If we're making an exhibition, for example, it's frankly cheaper to do so with a couple of partners in tow, and so we look abroad. And also there's a kind of missionary imperative as well. You know, Tate Britain's role is to spread the word about British art in the world, and so we find ourselves doing so internationally and feeling good about it. Over the past 10 years or so, I suppose we've probably offered exhibitions to around 30 institutions, mostly in America and Europe, where there's already a thirst for British art. But recently, we've begun to extend our horizons a little bit and to go to parts of the world where British art isn't quite so well-known and well-loved. We've, this past year, put on an exhibition of the works of Turner in Moscow and another one very similar in Beijing. And as Vicky mentioned, our Lure of the East exhibition went to Istanbul and to the United Arab Emirates as well. Now, I want to talk about Tate's relationship with the British Council in relation to those, the Turner and the Lure of the East exhibitions in particular, as a way of, in setting a particular context for this debate. I mean, why did we decide to work with the British Council? Firstly, because they're splendid people. Andrew and I get on like a house on fire. We thought it'd be more fun if we worked together. You know, in the end, we also thought it'd be rather nice to have a kind of safety net if anything went wrong in these distant places. You know, having a local embassy, a local British Council office would be very helpful. So from the Tate's point of view, we entered into a relationship with a quasi-political organisation, the British Council, for pragmatic and practical rather than idealistic reasons. However, I would concede that it'd be quite, you know, disingenuous of me to pretend that I had no interest whatsoever in the possible political impact of what we were doing in China or Russia or the Middle East. And of course, being a curator at heart, I naturally think that in the end, you know, art matters most, that art counts, that art stirs, and that mattering and counting and stirring the emotions and broadening of the horizons of any public we can get anywhere in the world is more important than anything else. And of course, changing the way people think is itself implicitly political. And for that Lure of the East exhibition, British Orientalist painting, we did indeed follow deliberately interpretation strategy which asked our audience to think in terms of the past in relation specifically to the political tensions of the present. And when that show was translated into a Middle Eastern context, the museums chose to follow, broadly speaking, the lines that we had set out in our interpretation here, and therefore there were quite serious debates about the relationship between the past and the present. And that did make some of our curatorial hearts beat faster and feel very warm and made us think that perhaps we had a kind of important social or political purpose to our profession. I would also acknowledge that Tate's participation in the British Council's 2004 exhibition of British contemporary art in Tehran in Iran, what that was supported by the Tate partly because we rather like the idea of, you know, being part of a slightly ambitious initiative that might stir a bit of discussion, a little freedom of speech in an envelope which, of course, was ultimately constrained by censorship and social control. Some people say that exhibitions in which the British Council are involved are necessarily diplomatic initiatives. My recollection of that project was that the Foreign Office was sort of scarcely aware that it was happening and didn't really know what to do with it once it was underway, and indeed were rather nervous of it happening in the first place. And while I therefore agree very much with Tiffany Jenkins's often quoted remark that the last thing we should ask culture to be is diplomatic, I can assure her and everyone here that in that instance, we weren't frankly being very diplomatic at all. But, and this seems to me the crucial point really, I do think we have to ask ourselves searching questions about the staging of almost inevitably flag-waving exhibitions of British art overseas, even when they're not conceived overtly as promotional vehicles for Britain, as many perceive British Council's exhibitions to be, or as diplomatic missions of some kind. It is frankly, all too easy to slip into the mode of kind of unwitting cultural imperialist, even in the way that we run our relationships with other institutions. I mean, you know, we're dealing sometimes with institutions that have never hosted an international loan exhibition before. And our professional procedures lead us sometimes to insist and to stipulate and to control the conditions of presentation. And this often is very irritating to the local venue, who may be very grateful for the expertise we offer, but are also slightly resentful of the power and experience that we seem to have. And there have been occasions on which we've been reminded that we're there for their benefit, not for ours. And I'm sure Anja will forgive me for reminding her of the occasion of when one such venue with whom we were collaborating specifically asked the Tate whether we could persuade the British Council to take a slightly lower profile in the publicity surrounding the show. For to them, an exhibition billed as a British Council exhibition felt and might look to their public as if it was a kind of quasi-diplomatic or even imperial exercise with the kind of dead hand of government not very far from the tiller. Whereas a Tate-branded project, according to the analysis of the local museum, felt and looked more like a real curatorial collaboration, purer of motive, arts-driven, closer to the passions of the people. I don't happen to mind that perception at all. And I do think it'll prove to be ultimately self-defeating if museums routinely declare themselves as having world agendas with some kind of political payback. International cultural events driven by the actual wishes of venues and their audiences, supported by us in the museum profession, rather than ones designed to match British institutional ambitions, must, in my view, be better for the world. And of course, being museum folk, we can't help wanting to make the world a better place. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Okay, Tim.
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you about the project for which I was curatorially responsible, which was taking the exhibition Masterpieces of World Ceramics, which was on a world tour. One of the venues we took it to was Damascus. And the V&A has a very, very large program of travelling exhibitions, to the extent that last year we had over 2 million visitors to the site in South Kensington and the one in Bethnal Green. But we also had over 2 million visitors to our travelling exhibitions. And that's an extraordinary thing, which is probably a one-off, but it shows how important our travelling exhibitions are. In this case, the V&A was invited to provide an exhibition for Damascus, Arab Capital of Culture 2008. And it was significant that the invitation wasn't from the Director General of Antiquities, who run the museums and galleries in Syria, but from the DACC, the Damascus Arab Capital of Culture, which had a lot of pull. And in being asked to do that, we actually had a suitable show that was available, which was Masterpieces of World Ceramics, which was created because when we were redeveloping the ceramics galleries in the V&A, of which phase two opened on the 18th of September, we'd created a timeline down the middle of the World Ceramics Gallery, which offered 120 pieces which illustrated the history of ceramics from 2000, well, now it's 3,500 BC, but in the exhibition it was 2,500 BC to the present. And, you know, the thing about ceramics is that the new galleries are top lit, because ceramics are one of the few things in a museum that you can show that are not damaged by light. They're not damaged by change of temperature. You know, but you must remember not to hit them or drop them. And one of the things that allowed us to do this world exhibition, in other words, it covers everywhere, the Americas, Africa, Asia and Europe, was that in previous cycles, the Arab Capital of Culture being called the Capital of Arab Culture, but they changed it, so it was the Arab Capital of Culture, and it wasn't tied down to Arab culture. And for us in the V&A, it was the first international touring exhibition that we'd done in the Middle East. Obviously, you don't have 2,000 visitors to 2 million, I mean, visitors to your exhibitions if you just tie them to this country. So we do a lot of work mostly in America, Europe, and Japan, but we're expanding that into other areas. But in terms of, for Syria, this was the first ever international touring exhibition to go to the country. So that made it a really big breakthrough. And I think you mustn't think of Syria as being an uncultured country because of that. Obviously, it's been culturally isolated because it's been politically isolated from many other parts of the world. And that's changed over the last couple of decades, but it's still true. But also that visual culture doesn't play such a large part in the cultural life of Damascus and other cities in Syria, that dance, theatre and music are more important. And so I think that's why this situation had arisen in part. But the main museum in Damascus is the National Museum, but it has absolutely no facilities for taking travelling exhibitions. The basement where the services are, such as conservation and storage for cases, actually has no communication with the ground floor. So if we wanted to do it there, we would have had to take stuff out of the building and in again every time we wanted to move it. And there were very narrow staircases, so it made you wonder how they got the very large pieces up the stairs that are in the galleries upstairs now. That meant we had to ask that we chose a venue, and we were able to do that with the help of Paul Doubleday, who was the exceptional British Council representative in Damascus at the time, but he moved before the opening. Unfortunately, he was moved to Tbilisi. So we chose the Khan Asad Basha, which is an 18th century caravanserai, which is a sort of roughly cubical building, which has a large covered courtyard in the centre. And one of the challenging things about it is it has stripy masonry, because it's built of layers of basalt and sandstone to give it, which is a characteristic thing of monumental buildings in Syria in that period, but it makes it rather a challenge to a designer if you're going to show stuff against this very strongly coloured stripy walls. One of the reasons for choosing this caravanserai, which is an 18th century commercial building, is that it was the passing trade, because it's actually situated off of a covered market street in the centre of Damascus, and you had locals and tourists going past. And as there's absolutely no local tradition of visiting exhibitions, we thought we might get some visitors that way. In fact, we were able to engage a locally based designer who proved to be very good. I mean, she's worked a lot on the restoration of traditional houses in Damascus, and because she chose the colour of the plinths for the cases very well, which meant that the show actually worked very well in that stripy room, well, stripy hall. The showcases, none are made in Syria, so we had to source those from Egypt. The shippers there had no experience of shipping art at all, and they were very good to learn, and they were amazingly cautious. So everyone, there was a huge armed guard as it came from the airport, and it was going about sort of 5 miles an hour to make sure that there was no one, because, you mustn't jolt ceramics. And the security was an issue. We had to, there wasn't any concept of providing a sort of CCTV and security guards in a sort of museum or antiquities setting to the level that we needed, because as Stephen was saying, you actually have to make sure that your exhibition survives. And in our case, we wanted it back for our own galleries, and we did have to change the security company to more professional guards, to ones who actually deal with consulates and things like that. But it was much more effort than normal. We had to manage the whole process from London rather than relying on a local institution. But the big rewards, well, one of them was the interpretation. Basically, when you saw people reading labels in the exhibition, this was the first time they would have had the opportunity to read a museum label as it occurs in a British museum in a Syrian setting, because the system of interpretation in many countries, including Syria, is actually really the guided tour rather than the self-starting label reader. And so they tell you what the object is. They tell you Palmyra, 17th century or something, and then they told you who dug it up. Well, 7th century, I meant to say. And then they told you who dug it up. But that's an example from the Palmyra Museum. But it was also accompanied by a conference for museum educators, which was sponsored by the World Collections Programme, which is a British museum-based and government-funded programme for this sort of purpose, for cultural diplomacy. And we were very pleased to receive 20,000 visitors in 6 weeks, because it was only it could only be open for 6 weeks because that was all the venue was available for. And of course, that brought us into 2009. So we were really the capping off of Damascus, Arab capital of culture. And that was, I think, 20,000 visitors in a country like Syria in such a short week, a short period, was a real triumph. And I, what I really liked about it was the nature of the visitors, because not only did Syrians come in, but also the tourists in Damascus are not the tourists we would think of necessarily as being Italians and French people, but they were people from the Gulf and from Iran. And on the opening day, I went upstairs to the first floor and looked down, and I saw a man taking a photograph of his two wives next to this huge statue of Hebe that we have, which is the largest Copenhagen porcelain statue. And as they moved away, one of the women threw up her chador and pulled it back on again, and I realised, of course, that they were Iranian, and they were the sort of middle-class Iranians who wouldn't necessarily get... we wouldn't ever reach, basically, as the V&A. So the press reaction was very good, but that, of course, it's a totalitarian regime, so that doesn't mean such much. If you ask me the thing that I liked about it best, that was the Simon Jenkins' comment in The Guardian, which is that the V&A was treating the Syrians on equal terms through taking them this great exhibition, because Simon really, really liked the exhibition. And we're about to repeat this touring of the Middle East with the Jameel Prize, which is a prize that we gave for the first time in July, which is for work, contemporary work inspired by Islamic tradition. And we will now be taking that on a tour of the Middle East, including, we hope, Syria in Damascus. And they seem very keen for it. And there we have there is a slightly different issue that we have to face in the sense that the last exhibition was about world ceramics. And so it wasn't, and there was nothing British about it, except it was a British collection. In this case, of course, we're in danger of taking Islamic art, but I'm not quite sure what that is in terms of contemporary, to Islamic countries and telling them this is what your art is, which we have to avoid. But that's the big issue we have there. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Just to give you the headline quote from that Simon Jenkins article, because it so pertains, it says, "This show's diplomacy is for real and it's worth a million millibands. The V&A exhibition takes Syria seriously in their own capital, unlike the hectoring speeches of the Foreign Secretary." So that's kind of very pertinent to tonight's discussion. Andrea, your thoughts, please.
Thank you, Claire. I noticed that half of the title of this debate has fallen off the screen, and it's rather important because we were asked to talk about whether cultural diplomacy is a force for good or not. And I accepted the invitation to speak tonight because there are two words I particularly dislike about this evening's talk. And one of them is culture, and the other is diplomacy. Culture is a word that has been adopted by bureaucrats and politicians to mean everything and nothing. It is warm and reassuringly vague. And it has the great merit of being able to allow the arts to be seen as something specialist and elitist, where all it takes for culture is really anybody who's in charge, really, to form an opinion and, hey, you've got culture. Diplomacy, well, the nicest description I've heard of diplomacy is it's about the intercourse between nations. Actually, I'm sure most of us will recognise the term as a byword for the skill and the tact with which we advance and promote and defend national interests in an international forum. Marry those two words up together, and you basically have the amorphous allied to the vaguely ambiguous. And it's a marriage which I think is... it says something about the bumptiousness of statecraft. I think that's really antipathetic to what the arts, or what we believe the arts really should be doing, which is about precision, about truth, and about directness. Stephen has talked, and he's certainly written about, the unintended consequences of 9/11, meaning that we have a greater understanding and appreciation, and Tim has also spoken about this, of the art of the Islamic world. That must be to everybody's good. The 22 countries of the Arab world have been very much below the radar of our recognition in the post-war Second World War settlement. But as we have found it necessary to bring into our vision and understanding Islamic art, so government, with its newfound interest in culture, promoted, I must say, by some of our national institutions, has rather taken this to mean that we, culture, which of course they're paying for, or you're paying for from the taxpayers' purse, culture is not going to come free. We're not going to just do cultural diplomacy because we think it's jolly good and art's a nice thing for people overseas to understand. We're going to do it with an agenda which government can understand. We're going to use performance indicators and we're going to use outcomes. And what are those outcomes that government constantly insists on? They are social change. The arts shall be an agenda for social change and for behavioural change. We've all heard about regime change. I, sitting in the position that I do, I see across my desk endless bids for arts being rejected because they are not showing sufficient attention to behavioural change in those with whom we are engaging. If we're going to promote the arts, and I'm sure everybody in this room feels we should, we must do it disinterestedly and on the terms that the arts themselves are about, that is, about individual, personal and human values. When we sent Bridget Riley to Czechoslovakia in 1971, it wasn't because we thought she would bring down the Iron Curtain, although I can actually think of very few people more likely to have done so than Bridget, but it was to enable people living behind the Iron Curtain to have access to new ideas and to innovation, to show that beliefs other than those that they were exposed to could coexist. And I think that is a very, very important function of cultural diplomacy, or actually I would call them cultural relations. When Steve McQueen is going to be shown at the National Portrait Gallery, as he will next year, he will show Queen and Country. It's a work which is profoundly anti the government's position on Iraq, and yet he is showing it in a British museum funded by you, the taxpayer, but it is not a government position. And we have the freedom in the West to allow our artists to express themselves freely and humanly, and we show our artists overseas in order to allow other people to engage with that, to know that there are other worlds, to be connected to that other world, to feel plugged into that other world, but not to bring about regime change. If regime change happens, because people get ideas. And when we talk about cultural diplomacy, another reason I don't like it is because diplomacy is no longer conducted exclusively in the gilded ministries of the diplomatic corps. It is far more of a people-to-people experience these days. I don't need to tell you, a young audience, of the electronic means by which people communicate, but the power to change things comes as much from people, perhaps more, than it does from governments in the past. But a relationship, cultural relationships, is not actually about promoting, as Stephen says, you know, the British way of life. We're showing you marvellous British things. It is as much about listening as it is about showing. You cannot have a relationship without another party in the arrangement. And it is incredibly important for us, if we're showing our art, to listen and to see the art of other people. We may not like the countries in which we sometimes work. We may not like their regimes. But if we don't listen, we will not understand why those regimes exist in the way that they do. And if we don't understand, we will not overcome our own ignorance and our own fear. And we will not actually, in the end, come to agreement, which I think the motion today is about world peace. The reason I don't like cultural diplomacy, but I am profoundly supportive of museums and everything they do, is not because I believe that museums are capable of eradicating poverty any more than they can bring about world peace, but that what our great encyclopedic museums are about, bringing artifacts from a huge array of different cultures and showing respect for them. Showing equal respect for what comes from Syria as what comes from Nigeria, as what comes from Ghana, as what might come from Peru. And that seems to me a very first step in the process of understanding. It is the business of all of us, I think, to increase understanding and appreciation, not because we think this is a nice thing necessarily to do, because actually that is the process by which we will appreciate and overcome our own ignorance. I think the British Museum and the V&A does a wonderful job of dispelling our ignorance about a whole range of other cultures. But cultural relations is not an event, it's not a single exhibition. It is a process, and it's a very long process, and it's incremental, and it takes a huge amount of time, and it has to be done continuously. It won't change the world, but it may make the world a better place, and it's certainly a contribution, a very small one maybe, but it's certainly a contribution towards making the world, hopefully, a better and more socialised place.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrea. And Tiff.
Okay, well, what I want to talk about here today isn't international collaboration or sharing. I think that should happen automatically, and I think any sort of cultural activity that ends at the border would be a bizarre thing. Instead, I do want to talk about the role of museums and the arts as explicitly promoting cultural diplomacy, that is, making a political contribution, a kind of improvement upon international relations. This is quite a vague term, but you can see it being increasingly used in both government documents and also museum and gallery documents post 9/11, as Claire said in her introduction. And it's an important thing to sort of think about that, is that as foreign relations becomes more discredited, as the work of America and Britain, particularly in Afghanistan more recently, and Iraq, becomes more problematic, they themselves see culture as a useful tool. Demos is a think tank that has written on this subject, and they write that cultural today is a central component of international relations. It's time to unlock its full potential. So this think tank, in their report, which is embraced by a number of museums and galleries, sees culture as a way of easing international problems, as has the Lib Dem MP Don Forster. I think this is highly problematic. I think it's a highly problematic strategy for international relations, number one. I also think it's very detrimental to the collections and the work of our museums and galleries. And I want to sort of explain why I think that is, whilst also talking about the differences between cultural diplomacy today, really as it's evolved in the last 10 years, and as it was originally sort of in the early 20th century. So in the past, cultural diplomacy saw its heyday in the 1950s in America during the Cold War, when the US armed itself with jazz, abstract expressionism, and modern literature. And it sent, in the 1950s, more than 100 acts to 89 countries. So people like Louis Armstrong, Charlie Parker, and they were there to bring life to concepts of liberty and really to show American values were alive and well. The primary job of the Office of War Information during this period was to promote American values. So you could say, what's wrong with that? Louis Armstrong's pretty cool. Wouldn't you mind listening to him? I think there are problems with it when it becomes explicit kind of government policy. It allows the formalization of a subservient relationship of the arts to government. So the arts are considered their handmaiden. It assumes that artists within America have the same gender as the American government, and that's actually often not the case. And we may have less in common with our governments than we do with other people across the world. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary contradiction to use black artists to go abroad to promote concepts of freedom at the time you had a formerly segregated society. It forces, or it certainly encourages, art to be propaganda, and it can potentially reduce its complexity. And obviously, art has a life of its own, and it can rebel and react against that. But that is the danger with it. And of course, the flip side of using art as propaganda, putting it as a tool of government, is that it can also be suppressed then. And we saw under the McCarthy years, the kind of really just the removal of the film industry in case that they were seen to be promoting communist propaganda. So that was then, and this is now. What's new today in terms of cultural diplomacy, and what's wrong with it today? I think there are two significant changes that are worth reflecting on. The first I've mentioned already, and that is the discrediting of America and Britain abroad, and really the usefulness of culture to politicians. I mean, Tony Blair clearly found, with his policies in Iraq, he clearly found it useful to talk about the wonderful cultural achievements of the Islamic world. I wouldn't suggest that he didn't think that was a wonderful achievement, but it certainly softens his image. And you've got some similar processes going on in Iraq now with the relationships with the British Museum. You can see the benefits of it, because the British Museum and embedded archaeologists are working with the American army to protect cultural sites. There are benefits to that, namely the protection of cultural sites, but it does legitimize or certainly valorize the role of the army there. So that's the first significant change. The second, which I think is a really interesting one, and we've heard some of it this evening, is this idea that it is consciously post-imperialist. So people are very concerned about imposing British values or American values. So it's far more, we are told, about listening rather than imposing our views. And I think that's absolutely truly held, but it's still pretty problematic. What I think you see happening today in the notion of cultural diplomacy is the conception of culture in a very broad sense, in a more like almost an anthropological sense, as essential to people's identity. And culture is almost given a healing kind of role. It's used in many programs now to build nation states, and I think rather ineffectively. So whilst cultural policy of the past would have promoted American values or it would have promoted British values, the best that there is and all the rest of it, today it's credited as being as a source and solution to conflict. You can see that with somebody like James Fennell, once culture minister, who argues, we live in a shrinking world with more contact between cultures and countries than ever before. We need to learn how to live side by side, giving dignity to our differences and understanding our similarities. London's museums are one of the best places in the world to understand those different cultures, but we can deepen that understanding by creating connections with other museums around the world. So what he's saying here is that really the problem in the world is that we just don't get on. We just don't really understand these nice Islamic people, and we need to see some more of their art, which I think is a very problematic way of seeing cultural relations. But you can see it echoed even in Neil McGregor and James Cuno's work when they talk about promoting museums of tolerance. You know, the World Museum now will demonstrate the interconnections of culture, and therefore this can be used for tactical and political problems. It sounds at best a little bit naive, a bit like world peace, but I think it is highly problematic. You can see it, I think, in some of the rather brilliant but flawed exhibitions at the British Museum, which have this tendency to try and link every kind of political problem today to that of the past. So Sudan, even the Shah Abbas, you know, was meant to kind of expose problems in Iraq or expose problems in Darfur. And actually what it did is compress them. So you go to these exhibitions, you assume that you're going to learn more about the present, but actually the objects primarily from the past, and it just becomes highly confusing. And what it ended up doing, particularly in the Darfur case, in the Sudan case, was presenting these people as inherently conflictual all the time, because it just basically kind of viewed it through the prism of violence in the contemporary period. So I think there are major problems with the way in which sort of culture and that role is conceptualized today. I think we should see this as something that museums kind of do see very much as a legitimizing process for themselves. It makes them look good, it makes them appear to have a kind of contemporary and social role, but what it ends up doing, apart from not improving international relations, is problematizing the collection, or rather politicizing the collection. So instead of seeing objects as something that was created maybe, you know, in Syria hundreds or thousands of years ago, that can tell us about those cultures then, that we can admire and respect today, we try and ask it to solve a problem in the present. And that entirely removes any of its glory and entirely shuts down our understanding, because we're just trying to ask it to do something for us today, and it absolutely will not do it. So, no, I don't think culture should be diplomatic.
Okay, thank you very much, Sue. Finally, Jonathan.
Okay. While listening to all this, I suddenly remembered that when the British Museum did one of its first kind of culturally diplomatic exhibitions about the ancient Persian Empire, called Forgotten Empire, and managed to write the most undiplomatic, seriously undiplomatic article of all time that I've ever done, where I wrote a review of it. And I mean, this is about the ancient Persian Empire, which fought the Greeks. I mean, the Greek identity in the classical Greece was formed in its war of independence, if you like, or war against the mighty Persian Empire. And the exhibition was very much about saying, well, the Persians were fantastic, and Persepolis is a wonderful city, and I did write this review saying, well, yeah, but, you know, classical Athens was a lot you know, was a greater culture. And I had no idea how much offence that would create. I mean, I got hate mail from inside Iran for months, actually. I mean, really, it was a campaign and everything, and it was stuff published, and it was terrible. Because, of course, I just didn't understand that. Actually, it was a very specific thing that a lot of, it wasn't the Iranian government, it was people who were either in Iran or part of the Iranian diaspora who see themselves as secular and, you know, as dissidents. And if I'd identify with Persia as being a pre-Islamic thing, and so it was really a real kind of, you know. But it was still true. It's still true that the exhibition, I think that exhibition was an example of where I'd agree with you. When the British Museum, we haven't talked that much about the British Museum, so I'll talk more about it, because I've reviewed quite a lot of its exhibitions and I live near it, and so I've seen it. And it's, you know, it's really Neil McGregor's British Museum that I think has made a narrative about cultural diplomacy, which is a very powerful one. And that exhibition, I think some of the early exhibitions it's done in the name of that were more, you know, potentially clumsy. They've got better as they've gone on. But the idea, another thing that I remembered when Andrew was talking was about the British Council, is that it's Trafalgar Day. But I do remember one of the best exhibitions I've actually ever seen was an exhibition about curated by Lucien Freud of Constable at the Grand Palais in Paris, which was a British Council thing. And then I was just thinking about, you know, we have to work with these harsh regimes like France and. I'd like to take this on head on, really. The point, it's absolutely true that since 9/11 in London, we've seen an extraordinary proliferation of exhibitions which have introduced the art of the Middle East more clearly and also have looked hard at Encounters. There's a great one called Encounters at the V&A, which is one of the first ones. Neil McGregor's British Museum has created a whole kind of, it really has become this sort of cultural diplomatic agency. The fruits of that, for an art lover, are enormous. Despite my criticisms, I don't agree that the British Museum's exhibitions are massively flawed. I mean, I did, when they first started, I thought the agendas were a little bit clunking. In the case of the Persian one, and yes, probably also the Sudan one. But since then, they're such great exhibitions. And one of the points here is that, as a critic, just as an art lover, and as somebody who likes to learn history and just, you know, look at this stuff and learn from it, I kind of almost don't care whether it's good cultural diplomacy. What I am aware of is that the fruits of cultural diplomacy, in fact, you could almost argue it's a kind of the British Empire Strikes Back, because the rewards of cultural diplomacy for us are huge. If you go to the British Museum, as I regularly do, it's not just that you've got, I mean, at the moment, you've not just got this fantastic Aztecs exhibition, which clearly is made possible by kind of diplomatic, as it were, links with Mexico. You've also got a free exhibition of ancient Japanese prehistoric art, which is stunning. And they also had a recent one, Treasures of the Shanghai Museum, again free, which are stunning things, which are clearly have been made possible by these kinds of diplomatic activities that McGregor has engendered. And also, incidentally, I think it's odd to say that the British Museum is sort of guilty of collusion in the Iraq War or anything, because they were one of the first people to condemn and to criticise things that had happened in that case. But as I say, and from the point of view of art, it's just great. From the point of view of, is there a downside? Well, as I say, I got into trouble for saying what I've learned is that I've sort of had to negotiate my own diplomatic route in some ways, because if there are more exhibitions, big blockbuster exhibitions about world art in London, that also means there are more opportunities to write about it, which also means there are more opportunities to say the wrong thing. And maybe one thing, when I think of a diplomat, I think of somebody who's clearly very effective at communicating, but also somebody who might not be entirely honest, who says what people want to hear. And maybe the most brutal and most dangerous issue here, when you have museums on the one, when museums are participating more and more in a conversation in a global conversation about art, and the diplomatic the danger of diplomacy for me is actually, I suppose, the danger of dishonesty. I mean, the danger of saying all art is equal, relativism, I suppose, you know, of always having to say that all world traditions are not equally interesting. They are all equally interesting, but that there was, well, I suppose it comes back to this problem I had with Persia, that is there a grand narrative of Western art anymore? Are we going to deliberately suppress the grand narrative of Western art from classical Athens through the Renaissance to Jackson Pollock and the great American abstract expressionists, who I think, you know, were rightly promoted by America in the 50s because they were so important. And I think, you know, how does that fit in? At the moment, I don't think that it matters because there is so much for us to learn, actually, about, say, Islamic art, that and so much to learn. And we learn a lot about our own art traditions from it. And at the moment, I'm researching a piece about the Middle Ages, and you see the connections between Islam and Christian art in the Middle Ages so in interesting ways. But there is clearly a potential for, you know, for lies, diplomatic lies, and just reducing everything to the same and losing sight. And, you know, we'll never put on an exhibition that says the glory of the Renaissance anymore because we're too busy putting on exhibitions to please everyone and to please other cultures and to participate in. And I suppose I'll end with this thing. I think it's absolutely true. A lot of this has happened post 9/11, but isn't there a dark side to that? Is there a darkness to that? Isn't that a rather disturbing fact? Not that it took terrorism to make us, you know, see the truth, but also perhaps that this isn't so much cultural diplomacy as perhaps a cultural panic. I don't really think that. One more note I just want to end on, just the opposite, if you like. Does it help if you look at Islamic art, if you go to an exhibition like the one that they recently had at the British Museum, if you go to the beautiful gallery at the V&A and you look at Islamic art, does that help anything? Does that change anything? Does that make you see Islam in a more, you know, does it change you? And I suppose my honest belief is, on the one hand, that should never be the reason you look at art, because you should be looking at art. On the other hand, yes, it does, because art is profoundly humanising. So in that sense, I completely believe in cultural diplomacy, but I do worry that diplomacy means lying.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, far too much on the table. Just quick whiz round, give people a chance to kind of come back on anything. But I suppose, Stephen, picking up on a couple of points to you, but do feel free to kind of come back on anything. You made the point that, you know, it kind of, it made you feel rather good as somebody involved in museum curation, to think that you were involved in some very important social, political purpose. It kind of gave a kind of added edge to the work, as it were, to think that you might be doing some good in the world, bringing about peace. But you know, isn't that kind of a vanity project? And isn't there a danger of that being what this is all about, museums and galleries and the cultural establishment feeling rather defensive about their role and not feeling, oh, nobody really appreciates us, and then suddenly kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say was that, yeah, 90% of my own personal motivation is taking art out into the world, and you may say that's a pretty old-fashioned kind of concept and anyway, but I know that's what, you know, I love doing. But I was trying to be honest and saying, you know, it made me feel quite self-important that here I was, you know, with, you know, President Medvedev in Moscow or whoever it was, you know, and I just do feel uneasy, and because I share that view about the vanity, I do feel uneasy about museums standing up and claiming their political purposes and role in the world, because I don't ultimately think that's what museums are there for, and I think it does undermine the value of the works that we have and ultimately the significance of the job that we do in terms of communicating with the public, and so you know, Neil makes me nervous in that sense.
But in a way, then, what you've just said, which I absolutely appreciate, But one of the other things that you said, and one of the things that's often claimed, in fact, in response to what Tiffany wrote when the Demos report came out, I remember John Holland saying, no, the only way that this works is precisely because museums and galleries and art is independent from government. And you actually said, you know, it's true, the exhibition's kind of cleaner and purer. This could be seen to be more of a con. I was thinking, so what you're saying is Miliband can't get away with it, but it's quite possible that Neil McGregor or a museum can, but effectively that's just simply denying that there's a political purpose when there is a political purpose. And sometimes the politicians are saying, we can't get away with this, but if we let them lot loose, they look like they're independent.
Yeah, well, I mean, a more optimistic slant on it would be to say that it's quite a convenient alliance between two partners who have completely different motivations and each get out of the product something different, and it isn't actually any more sinister than that.
Yeah, but, I mean, I just wanted to reflect on some of the things that you were saying, Andrea, or to ask you quite clearly. Mm. It seems to me, or one of the things that I'm concerned about, is that this is a kind of new instrumentalism. Mm. There has been quite a kickback, particularly recently, about the kind of outcome-driven arts, you know, arts for social inclusion, you know, exhibitions for the mentally ill and inner-city youth and everybody, and the art gets sidelined by that. But somehow there's been less kickback on this. I mean, it seems it's almost at the very time that I was reading all of these people saying, yes, we're not going to do that, they then said, there's a greater purpose to art. It transcends boundaries, and it sounded all very wonderful. And then they said, we should be doing more in international relations. And you thought, well, isn't that just a more grandiose instrumentalism that we're falling into? Do you recognise that, or do you think
that's... I recognise it, but I would answer it by telling you a story about an American writer called Richard Ford, who was a Southern writer living in Mississippi, never went abroad till he was 42 and won the Pulitzer Prize. And then the US State Department asked him to go to Europe, and then after the fall of communism to go to Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently to Egypt. And every time the letter came from the State Department, it said, we'd like you to go and give a book tour. And it was great. He went and promoted his books. He was translated into 23 languages, so of course he was advancing his career and publishing rights at the same time, but he always gave interviews every time he was there. And then after 9/11, he got a letter from the State Department and said, we'd like you to go abroad to X country to promote US values. Now, he'd never, ever had that phrase before. And his reply is, I won't go because I don't promote American values. I promote my literature. And when I go abroad as an individual, and this is where I would dispute with Tiffany, this idea that all art is subjugated somehow to... all art is so very, very narrowly seen by an audience. It's not. If you, an audience, read a book, whether the US government might be promoting Richard Ford, who could be sitting here, you will read it in the way that your own experience determines how you read it. And I think contexts do determine how we view things. And again, I don't agree with Tiffany that you could only ever see an object as a historical thing. It may have been made 5,000 years ago, and it had a culture and a purpose, but that we are, whatever is exhibited today is contemporary, that's what I believe, that we will bring to it our collective experiences. So I think the community that is actually trying to work with art is very wary of government taking these instrumental points of view. That's why at the beginning I said I don't like the way that government has recruited culture, because it's made culture adversarial. You know, it's their culture versus our culture. But I think enlightened agencies, and I would like to hope that mine is one of them, manage to negotiate that particular difficulty and try very hard not to be seen doing, you know, art for behavioural change.
Okay, thanks. Tim, just do you feel a lot of these pressures? I mean, it's a bit like your day's come now, isn't it? Because, you know, you're the middle-aged Eastern curator who... I'm not suggesting you weren't famous before, but suddenly everybody wants to understand the Middle East, so they all come rushing to the Middle Eastern curator at the V&A. But do you feel the kind of pressure of that being not quite... because they think you're a brilliant curator, no disrespect, and I'm sure you are.
Well, you know...
No, I'm sure he is, but you know what I'm saying.
No, I mean, you know, there are two people in London who do my line of business, as it were, apart from my colleagues in the V&A, and the other person is Venetia Porter at the British Museum. And when we get together, we've been friends for 30 years or something. I mean, a very long time. And when we get together, we do comment on the fact that we do seem to work rather hard these days. And there has been a tangible change in the amount of work we have to do. But talking again about the British Museum, the whole issue about bringing in exhibitions like the Forgotten Empire exhibition, and the British Museum actually doing a big deal with the cultural authorities in Tehran, and the British Museum's official reaction to the invasion of Iraq, it was muted, but it was oppositionist. And these things were actually done outside the framework of normal diplomatic relations. And what's happened is that what the challenge is that the government has decided that this is a good thing, and that's come afterwards. So it's we were doing these things before, and now the government has latched onto it, and that's where the problem comes for us, I think. But also that when you're dealing with a situation like Iraq, you protest at the beginning, but you try and do the things that are positive for the future as well, even if that does involve cooperating in certain ways with the occupation authorities, as they were. It is a wonder why there are plenty of archaeologists in Iraq. Why aren't they embedded with the US forces? Because we all know why. But the issues are genuine in terms of that. But I don't think you have to remember that the cultural organisations in this country, anyway, are quite independent in comparative to, say, in France, where everything is approved very centrally.
Jonathan, you made the point that you do learn something if you go and you look at the Islamic art. Hopefully you do learn something. That would be good. But it's what you learn, because what I find irritating is the idea that if I go and look at it, I'm going to either understand what happened on 7/7 or understand something about what motivates Middle Eastern conflict or understand something about current affairs. And this sort of on the one hand, if I kind of go and understand something more about Persia, that somehow that's going to give me a new insight that will be more tolerant, because I'll understand that the whole history of that region is not all violence and blood and guts and all the rest of it, because they were really multicultural, nice people. But then, that's A, it tells me what I'm meant to learn, and B, it's a nonsense that I can possibly learn that. It's at least politically illiterate, because it doesn't understand what happened on 7/7, arguably. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I know that you think we're getting gain out of it, but do you see what the nervousness there is?
My personal gain, I completely agree that any kind of overly simplified political narrative just doesn't work, and there have been several instances of that. But with Islamic art specifically, I think there's clearly a very specific, I look at it selfishly, I look at art selfishly, I'm looking for my sense of beauty to be gratified. It is gratified very naturally by Islamic art, and always has been. I mean, when I was a student, I hadn't been to Spain until I was a student, and we went on a trip around Spain, and we got to the Alhambra, and it was just, it's like being on a magic carpet, and it was really, really one of the most sort of, swooning sort of aesthetic experiences I've ever had. And I think what happened then was we thought, and in Cordoba as well, but the whole sort of Spanish Andalusian thing. I remember coming back up and ending up in Barcelona, but even, it all seemed disappointing, actually, after that. I didn't realise that, perhaps you'll correct me, but clearly Andalusia was one of the absolute high points of Islamic culture, or art, or architecture. The year after that, we went to Istanbul, and I remember being comparatively disappointed by the mosques in Istanbul, and sort of, oh. No, but also...
It's not a good thing to say to someone who's a Turkish specialist.
No.
I must go back. I really must go back. What I really want to say is that having recently, again, obviously there's so much of... these things have become so... we're all looking at these things again, or have the opportunities to look at them. And I do think... it's kind of crude, but... And I also did a big project about African art as well, which involved going to, you know, some parts of Africa, and because there was a big sort of Africa, there was a big thing about art, modern African art in London a couple of years ago. And I just it does change your perspective. The truth, and it's crude, but you know, racism and intolerance are racism and intolerance, and you know, we can get all sophisticated and complicated about what these things are, but in the end, contempt for it, you know, hatred of Islam means saying Islam never created anything worthwhile. And you do have, one extreme people who say, he'll say that, and who did a few years ago when, you know, you did have people. I mean, obviously, I work with blogging and things, and you know, and the whole, you know, some of the things you read and were being said a few years ago really were kind of, you know, the West is everything comes from the West, and you know, I mean, that kind of madness obviously does go.
And
you know, you it's humanizing. It's deeply humanizing to realize. I mean, Islam really has created some of the most beautiful things on earth. That affects how I see Islam.
Okay, very quick, Sif, because you've been accused of all sorts of things, so you might as well just come back. And then, audience, get ready to put your hands up.
Okay, well, I want to respond to Jonathan's point, really, which is, where's the harm, considering there's been the most amazing exhibitions that have been put on over the last 10 years, and there certainly has. It has been a real feast of riches. But I think at the same time, over those last 10 years, you can see the way in which culture has become politicised, to the extent that there are all sorts of debates over what should be shown, should this be taken off, let's remove that, it might offend people because of their culture, it might be offensive to other people. And that's what we are encouraging. Yes, we may at the same time be putting all sorts of exhibitions on, but we're giving it such a role and such a potency that we're encouraging people to fight over it rather than just go and see it. Now, if I said the Parthenon and marbles to you, you wouldn't think particularly of ancient Greece. You'd think of the debate between Greece and the British Museum, and I think that's what we're setting up to be the future of the way we see museums and galleries, that we see it as a way to fight over all sorts of different interests, to affirm our identities, to make ourselves feel better, or to kind of take off the shelves because of offence. And that is incremental, but that's the way we're kind of promoting culture today, and I think that's a problem.
OK, hands to anyone who wants to speak, please. OK, that's very too quiet. Right. OK, there's that person there in the middle. Yeah. There's microphones on both sides, so, yeah.
I just wanted to pick up on something Jonathan Jones mentioned. I thought it was very insightful to mention the danger of diplomatic lies, or the danger of showing interpretations of a culture that are one-sided or agenda-driven. Perhaps less so from exhibitions from the Tate or from, you know, our country to other countries, but exhibitions shown here from other countries. And I just wanted to put forward the idea that maybe before we become fixated with the term cultural diplomacy, it might be useful to use different terms like cultural conversations or interactions, and kind of foster better interaction or management between countries. For example, having discussions of what the exhibition could be before going in with a set agenda, so that there's not a particularly one-sided view of an exhibition.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else? Yes, so this person down here, and then there's a couple, a few over there. Yeah.
I was wondering, with the power of curators to decide what goes into exhibitions and what exhibitions are shown, is there not the danger that exhibitions are not so much showing culture, but that curator's representation of that culture?
Okay, thanks.
I was struck by Jonathan's point, I think, about the reticence maybe about the Western grand narrative, because if we're, you know, if government on the one hand, and maybe Stephen, this is your point about a convenient alliance, if government on the one hand is ticking a box in terms of getting some diplomacy done on the cheap, if you like, and not having to send Miliband out there where he probably will fail to make a decision anyway, and museums and institutions on the other hand are ticking a box in terms of getting some funding for things they want to put on, are we, you know, paying a price in terms of making what we do put on really anodyne? Because can we imagine sending exhibitions abroad that are going to offend Muslims, but might be of great art, right? Because I think that, you know, art does have an intrinsic value other than any kind of is separate of any instrumental justification for it in terms of social outcomes, regime change, or whatever you like. Some stuff is just good. And as you said, Jonathan, you know, classical Athens maybe has more euphoric than Persian. So we can't even have that debate, if you like, because we'll get offered an anodyne exhibition that won't offend anybody, will be culturally respective, equally of Persia, Nigeria, Ghana, Peru, line them all up, and we'll give them equal treatment. How then are we able to make any value judgments about the value of art? How can it have that humanising effect on us, because we think this is more beautiful, more true than something else? We risk giving up on that entirely, I think.
Okay, the person in front of you there, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah, yes, I wanted to pick up on the grand narrative idea, because I think it's quite dangerous. And the one in particular is the fact that you asserted that about the important 1950s American abstract painters, and I wonder whether they are important because there was a campaign that you know, that then self-perpetuated the idea, or whether, you know, and if other people are put in shade by not being part of that narrative that was being promoted by the US. I'm not questioning the you know, the quality of their work in any way. It's just this idea of there being narratives, and whether or not the government has actually created has created the value in that narrative.
Okay, thanks. So I've got Shirley Dent right at the back, and then there's another person on the back. Then I'm going to come and get quick things, and then I'll come back out. Yes, I'll take you all.
Thanks. Just returning to what Stephen said at the first, art matters most. Damn right, absolutely right. The thing that I'm worried about in all of this is excellence in art, which is universal, and we see that represented on lots of all the organisations on the panel. But I do think something's been lost here. I'll just give you a little example of what I mean. And I think cultural diplomacy nowadays is different to what it was in the past, and we've already heard examples of the Cold War, etc. But I like ballet, and when Rudolf Nureyev defected, that was a coup. It wasn't a coup because Rudolf was going to, you know, enlighten us as to Russian folk dance. It was because universally he was known as the best dancer, choreographer in the world. Whether it was the Bolshoi, or it was, the New York City Ballet, or it was the Royal Ballet. So what I just want to put to everybody on the panel is, in the search for cultural diplomacy nowadays, which does seem to be different, it seems to be a different sort of cultural diplomacy, what happens to that idea of universalism and excellence as just universal across the board? That's what I want to be helped to see when I go into a curated exhibition, is like, show me what is excellent in this, what's left out of this, why is this in this exhibition and something else isn't, why is this the best of human endeavour across the ages and across the world? I don't think we should forget that, I don't think anybody in the panel forgets that, but I want to know how cultural diplomacy either damages that or may help it today. Thank you.
Thank you. So there's that lady in the middle there. And then quick, what thoughts, just one thought each from the panel.
I just wanted to offer this, that when the big rash of exhibitions came out at the Royal Academy and all the other places since 9/11 relating to Islam, I felt, and I don't think I was alone in this, I felt a bit embarrassed as a British Muslim to feel that suddenly it seemed the subtext, the implication was that my humanity as a Muslim needed to be sort of underwritten by the Royal Academy. And I always thought that it was self-evident. So I just kind of felt a bit queasy that suddenly everybody's going, no, you're all right, don't worry, because I sort of thought I was.
Okay, so just, Stephen, any one thought you want to come back on?
I mean, the comment made from the cheap seats down here about curators ultimately being the people making the points, I think is actually a very fundamental one. You know, some of these big exhibition projects that we talk of in terms of their potential in this field of cultural diplomacy, and they do
almost accidentally sometimes, I think, play that role, are usually conceived as a result of curatorial discussions. And certainly the exhibition that we, on the Lure of the East that I mentioned before, that we took to the United Arab Emirates, with the British Council, the content of that show, the content of the interpretive programme we put together was not a result of, Tate sitting down with government to saying, OK, how can we each have our objectives fulfilled? It was about the curators of the show saying what they wanted to say about the art and trying to find ways in which 21st century eyes and minds could relate to 18th and 19th century objects. And to that extent, there was a naivety, if you like, a simplicity, but also a great honesty about that project. And so, maybe critical about its role in this wider, difficult world of cultural diplomacy. But, the purity of the curator's motives, for me, made it in the end a good project.
Andrew?
I'd just like to take this slightly away from the Middle East and the Islamic cultures, because I don't think it's entirely true that... obviously, there's been an acceleration since 9/11, but if you think back since the post-war period, in the 1950s and 1960s, Japan was hardly visible in Britain at all. We knew about it as a nation that was beginning to develop car industries and electronics. But Japan itself saw itself still very much as a defeated nation and as an inferior nation as a result. And it has taken 20 years for Japanese culture, the innovation, the fantastic artistry of Japan, over a series of 20 years of exhibitions here and of our taking British art out to Japan, with Japanese curators incidentally choosing them. I don't think it's true to believe that, we, British government, choose the art. It's always a process of collaboration, which is why I don't use the term diplomacy myself. I use the term cultural relations, which I think is a more accurate one. But I do think that the result of 20 years of working with Japan, of seeing Japanese art here, has enabled us to think differently about Japan and to think that its art is wonderful. And it's its own electronics and its car industries now are no longer the wonders of the world, and those things are moving elsewhere to China. Actually, what remains is this extraordinary sense of Japan's creativity. That's why I think that the relationship and knowledge about other countries is valuable in helping us to see other cultures as valuable as our own and from which we can learn something.
Okay, thanks. Johnson?
Well, a couple of people have mentioned the sort of the grand narrative of Western art sort of provocation, like I said. I'm saying I would like a history of world art in which we could simultaneously be fascinated by all the differences and all the different things, and also acknowledge that we wouldn't really even be talking about art or have art museums or be here tonight without this particular history in Europe of art, with a capital A, of the emergence of art as something, as a separate sphere of existence, not only as a religious thing or not, but as something, this very important thing, and the very specific history of art in the West, particularly since the Renaissance, but actually really going back to ancient Greece. And that needs to be, if this is really going to go on and on and on, this is going to be how museums particularly construct historical exhibitions, then at some point I think you're going to have to sort of take that on as well. And I do think there should also be some exhibitions, of course, about the triumph of Western painting and so forth, and finding a new language, as it were, coming back and turning it all around. Having said that, I do genuinely find the my eyes being opened to a lot of, to world traditions. And can I just say, maybe the British Museum sort of cycle has almost ended with that. I mean, Aztecs is almost the kind of another answer to this, or another way of framing it, because with Aztecs, it's a dead culture, which was wiped out. It wasn't a very nice culture. I mean, it was based on human sacrifice. It was also conquered by the Spanish in this terribly cruel way. And I think even the British Museum is pretty much... I haven't noticed much many political events around this one, and there's really almost nothing you can say. I mean, what really I believe is fantastic about art is that a society...
all societies have made art. Art does not have to come from a good place or even a civilized place. It can come from somewhere we wouldn't even describe as civilized and be great art. And there's a famous...
Okay, leave that quick.
A racist once said...
Hurry up.
It was one of the Bloomsbury critics in the early 20th century. You know, he has this thing about African masks and about how, and he talks about them in what we absolutely, racist way, you know, being, you know, the product of inferior cultures. And yet he says, but they're superior to any sculpture that any Englishman has ever made or something. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, we need that sort of excitement about art without having to kind of lard it and put on a load of sort of fibs about what it means.
Okay, Tiff.
Okay, well, on the grand narrative point, because I think that is quite important, I think you should see this as a relationship, really. As the grand narrative became criticised and the concept of Western culture became criticised, then museums collapsed in the face of it, not on their own. Obviously, a lot of other Western institutions have done this as well. That's when they start looking around for new value and new purpose, because the old just doesn't work anymore, it just doesn't cut it. So they do all sorts of things, social inclusion, education projects, lifelong learning, including cultural diplomacy. It's quite a frenetic and self-destructive process. But what it does do, it does mean that when the art that is being introduced to these new museums and galleries is kind of on show to everybody, yes, we get to see it, but also we're not able really to engage with it on its own terms. We're not able to compare it to other forms. The whole point about the canon isn't that it was static and fixed. It's that you constantly reappraised what was the best, and that's what we're not really able to do so much now.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
Yeah.
Anything?
Yeah, well, one thing is that, when it was very good to hear Jonathan's reaction to the Islamic Gallery in the V&A, because I think when we were creating it, one of the things we thought about that we were doing was to actually create something which, because it's visual and doesn't really need interpreting because it is just beautiful, would actually mean that visitors go away with a more informed idea about Islam in the past. But I think the existence of that collection in the V&A is it's largely a heritage of the 19th century, when Britain was top dog, and that the collections we have of China, India, and the Middle East are being reappraised. But what's happened is that I think it's not so much a 9/11 idea as the idea that as the news came through that the Chinese economy was growing by 11% a year, people began to think, oh, China's going to be important, and something similar happens about India and other places. And that this actually goes hand in hand with an idea about the crisis of the rise of the West model in art, is that we're actually getting a much fuller picture of that, you know, the Western tradition is only one tradition in the world. But we're only able to do that because we happen to have in Britain these national collections that are so rich, which because they reflect our colonial past. So there are all these sort of give and take things about it. It's in no way at any level is it value free.
I think the difficulty is that the point that you've just made about China was I went to one of the Cultural Olympiad talks with young people where they were told that they should go to all the China Now exhibitions so they could understand China now, even though the China Now exhibitions were about China in the past. And what that effectively does is kind of have an essentialist view of people, understand the Chinese, you know, kind of go and look at their, you know, which is not culturally enlightening for a start off. And secondly, whilst the West is running scare, you know, millions of people in China are queuing up to access the greatest of Western art. Not because it's Western, because it's the greatest of art. They're not embarrassed about the glories of Western art. It's the West that's having a nervous breakdown. That's what's so ironic. Anyway, over to the audience. Any more? Yes, that gentleman at the back, and then there's two people down here.
This is slightly tangential to the discussion, which I understand is about cultural diplomacy, but it just to point out that there is a whole group, a tranche of museums which are specifically concerned with human values which go across all cultures. Anti-genocide, anti-war, anti-torture. And of course a lot of great artists were committed to those sort of projects. I mean, for example, Picasso and the tapestry which is currently in the Whitechapel Gallery. It's very clear that it is political, very clear that it's making a point. What I've heard so far has been very much an indirect belief that if you do something, that you will improve cultural relationships between countries. But to what extent is there a responsibility on museums, which are putting a lot of artifacts out, particularly art, painting in that, painting, which has a clear political point, to include some of those issues in it? Or does it come back to this idea of the Western meta-narrative that we're all worried about it because we ourselves have been the main pervaders of the arms trade and torture, as seen politically, damaging the environment and so on? So what responsibility do these rather more pure museums have in that sense? Or should it be left entirely to those who have a very clear view of what is, if you like, culturally acceptable across the world?
Okay, thanks.
I think that I want to mention the issue of repatriation and how it's a major debate in the museum world. And if we think about that, how can we say that does the goal justify the means in that case, especially with situations like the Parthenon marbles, or especially with situations where artifacts have been acquired dubiously, and there's some stories in America about human remains and things. So how could that be culturally diplomacy on one side, where the goal is to be culturally okay and tick the box, but the means is actually not?
Okay, thanks. We've got a debate on that, Battle Satellite, 17th of November.
I wanted to ask a question about pragmatism and how pragmatic we should be about public funding and what potential damage that does. I mean, it's the UK Film Council, for example, recently gave the British Film Institute additional money to promote the London Film Festival internationally and to promote its international sort of presence. And that really wasn't so much about film as about Britain and Britain's status in the world. And given the British film industry is in a fairly poor state, at least the least we could do maybe is to promote, to be the country that promotes international film. But that's not about film. And the thing that worries me about this is that on the one hand, it's fantastic to get the money for that kind of thing. On the other hand, why can't the money be given just because it's a great thing to promote film and people's interest in film from all around the world? And so that, the London Film Festival is the one of the rare moments where you get film from all around the world coming to this country, and yet it's been done not for film, but for, the government's sort of like ideas about how it should be represented in the world.
Okay, thanks. Yes. So there's that lady there. Can you put your hands up now if you want to speak? So, yeah, and there, and then there.
Hi, I was just actually, that last point is relevant to what I was wanting to say, which is about money and about where it comes from and the questions of collusion and dishonesty that have been sort of mentioned here. I organised an exhibition in Afghanistan last year in Kabul. I looked for sponsorship wherever I could, and I ended up getting money mainly from the British Embassy in Kabul by ticking boxes saying, yes, it was going to fight terrorism, yes, it was going to diminish the possibility of hostility between nations, and it was going to encourage freedom of expression, God knows what. I ticked all whatever boxes I could, made whatever arguments I could to raise £20,000. as you all know, £20,000 in the context of our effort in Afghanistan is, just a drop in the ocean. So really, I had no moral dilemma about the fact that sometimes you have to dance with the devil to get the money that's necessary to do things that, well, in this case, that I believed was valuable. We had 8,000 Afghans come to an exhibition in 6 weeks. There are no audiences for the arts in Afghanistan, so that was a pretty unusual thing. So in response to the lady just making the point about the Film Council, if you've got the money within your powers and the conditions of your contract, do what you can with it. I mean, we know the government's got this instrumentalized policy of culture. You've got to try and make the best of it. You've got to try and get what you can out of it while fighting it, while making the points that you make. Tiffany, you're an important cultural critic, but at the same time, I'd say your anxieties about political correctness and collusion are overstated.
Okay, thanks. So I've got there, there, and there, and I think that's it. So there. No. Yes, sorry, in the middle there. Yeah. No, well, you might as well, because you've got it.
Okay,
yeah. So
fine.
Take this lady here first, and then you. Yeah.
Great, because I just wanted to reinforce what the previous speaker said. As someone who works in the learning department here, I was really interested in how many of you actually on the platform used the word learn in terms of what you wanted to be doing in the process of exchange and cultural relations. And I think that's something that's really important. And I think it's kind of complicated if Tiffany is saying that learning departments or learning as part of what museums are doing now is something that's problematic and weakening museums, particularly given that this event itself is run out of the learning department at Tate Britain, as many other things. And I wouldn't like to departmentalise things, because I think actually we're working very collaboratively across learning and curatorial, and indeed with artists. And I think one of the things that I'm getting from this discussion is a lot of discussions about the institutions without focusing on the way in which artists constantly are crossing over cultures and getting to know each other and working together to produce composite artefacts. They are not departmentalised. They're not necessarily seen as British or Syrian or wherever. They're actually talking to each other and very much on picking up what you were saying, Tim. And I just really wanted to... Somebody said earlier that people have... I think maybe it was you, Tim. I can't remember. Somebody said that people have more in common across the world than they have with their governments. And I think that's exactly what the previous speaker was talking about. And I think it's really important that we remember the way in which our institutions that we work for may have some relationship with the government, and we may ourselves have some relationship with the government, but we also have a relationship with people across our governments. And there's just a wonderful quotation that a young boy I worked with in Syria said, "When I draw, I feel part of the world." And I think it's really important to remember that we have emotional experiences that connect us way beyond our governments. And a lot of us don't necessarily feel best represented by our governments, but we want to keep on working across that. And it may result in peace, it may result in war, but what we want to do is keep on making those connections, and that's really important.
Okay, thank you. So there, then that lady there, and I think that's probably one more quick, and then final sentences, and then a glass of wine. Yeah.
I'm just curious about whether cultural diplomacy or cultural relations, as has been discussed, is primarily about the West and the rest, or whether it happens in other contexts too. So, for example, China's increasingly involved in Africa. Are there exchanges between Chinese and African institutions? Are there exhibitions of pre-Columbian South American art in the Middle East? I don't know, so maybe someone can shed light on that. But it would perhaps then also suggest something about why it is that the West is preoccupied with this. Is it because Western institutions recognise the universality of human cultures, which would be in the best traditions of Western art, or has it to do with the peculiar political position of Western institutions, the legacy of imperialism and so on, which would tend to be more in the worst traditions of Western dominations and global inequality? So, you know, maybe it's both of those, but which is dominant, and what is happening in the rest of the world?
Okay, thanks. This lady here, no, sorry, and that gentleman there, that's it, sorry. It's too late, I've gone over.
So,
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to the theme of the Parthenon marbles and the questions of repatriation, which I think are very relevant for cultural diplomacy. And I was wondering what, like, in terms of cultural diplomacy, are we talking about diplomacy via the arts, through the arts, or is there a separate sector which touches these questions, that is diplomacy for the arts? And how can you actually do this diplomacy about topics that are on parts of the history that were not everything but diplomatic?
Okay, thank you. And that gentleman there for the final thought.
Just picking up on the theme of the festival, the Battle of Ideas, perhaps a new way to approach museums or exhibitions as places for cultural relations is actually turn them into places of debate I think, Tiffany, you mentioned debates are happening about what should be going in an exhibition. Perhaps we should actually make them, instead of the curator being the only voice that's heard, actually bring debate and let people actually speak and communicate within exhibitions spaces themselves. And to sort of make people at a one-to-one level start building their own relations and reflecting on things and not just make it a solitary voice.
Just in case anyone ever cites me on this, we at the Institute of Ideas like the curatorial expertise and do not want the democratisation of curatorial exhibitions, for the record, because I don't want to get blamed, because I hate all that stuff. No, but I like debate, but I just don't want the idea that you can only put on an exhibition by asking everyone having a debate would A, destroy the exhibition, B, be Philistine, and C, a complete waste of everyone's time. And sometimes curators do know more about, you know, this gentleman knows a lot more about the history of Persia than I do, so you wouldn't want to ask me my opinion on that. You can ask me on anything else. Just my final thought, just the I thought it was very important what you said about, you know, I joined the world. The thing that's absolutely galling about all the rhetoric about cultural diplomacy that's coming from governments and institutions is the fact that at this very moment they're making it more difficult for artists to visit this country through the visas. Absolutely. They're completely tying it up. So there's an absolute scandal going on, which I know Dolan has been involved in a campaign against, and various artists have been, that actually, if you want to visit each of the artists and come here and kind of put on an exhibition, they kind of, you know, won't let you through the door. You know, you're treated like an illegal, you're treated with utter contempt. So much for universal appreciation of art from the government. And although I appreciate that this might be kind of coming from a government agenda, I think my concern and why I wanted to put this on was because there isn't a kind of resistance from the arts community. I understand getting money and you'll tick every box to get it. But at some point, intellectually, if you go along and nod your way through all this, it enters your heart. It becomes part of what you think and what you do. Not you personally, but broadly, right? That's what happens. You lose the fight. Why should the only basis on which the arts are recognised as, you know, is if they're going to deliver on what some external non-artistic body says? If the arts don't resist that intellectually, then art will, I'm afraid, suffer very badly and already has as a consequence. So that's the reason we organised the debate. And it's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, art across all boundaries and all the rest of it. We hate our governments, but we've also got to take responsibility for ourselves as well and do something about some of these bad things. Okay, final thoughts, and I'll finish with Stephen to give us a final word as he's the boss. And I'll start with you, Tim. Just whiz across.
Oh, God.
Yeah, anything you want.
Oh. Well, I think that there is a thing about the position of the West as the former imperial capitals having these huge collections, and they ask, we can do exhibitions like the World Ceramics, which cover everybody. But if you go to China, they have fantastic museums, but they represent the area that was part of China, not in this international way. And we're still on a project about expanding our collections, such as Tate Modern, for example, has been collecting actively in Latin America and including that in the scheme of things we can look at. I think that's a huge advantage, but it isn't value-free because we represent, you know, we need to be a bit more international about that in terms of what it's for and whether other people should be able to do it too.
Okay, thanks. Tiff, final thoughts?
Okay, I want to talk about repatriation, just to open up a whole new debate. I think what's interesting about the repatriation debate is really the response of people like James Cuno and Neil McGregor, both of whom are under great pressure, obviously, to return objects, including the Parthenon marbles. In response to that and other trends, they've started to talk about the World Museum, not the Universal Museum, because they couldn't possibly dare to say anything quite so blatant, but they talk about the World Museum, and they talk about it creating cultural diplomacy, museums of tolerance, improving cultural relations. Okay, so there's a relationship between that. But what they're doing, ironically, is reinforcing some of the concepts that repatriation claims promote in their claims. So repatriation claimers will often say, this is a brief rundown, by the way, will often say, return these objects, they will affirm our culture, they will make reparations, they will make us feel better, they will heal our communities. Neil McGregor's arguing, actually, that those objects do the same thing, they just do them in Bloomsbury. I think in the short term that will be effective. In the long term, it contributes to turning these objects into something, turning them into performing little affirmations of identity rather than the objects themselves. So I think it's corrosive.
Okay, yes. Thank you, Tiff. Jonathan?
I think
I think art has gained enormously, museums have gained enormously from this particular sort of story about cultural diplomacy that they've started telling. Whether it changes the world, it certainly has changed museums. And in the last analysis, the British Museum has gone from being an impoverished museum to one that's, you know, the envy of the world. And paradoxically, cultural diplomacy perhaps has put our great imperial museums, the V&A, the British Museum, Tate Britain in a way, back in their old place at the centre of the world.
Okay, thank you very much.
I just want to answer the question raised by a gentleman at the back about whether only the West does these sorts of exhibitions. It isn't the West, it's the developed world. And museums are basically urban constructs. And as you urbanise and cities become bigger, every developed city or culture wants to build museums and it wants to build theatres and it wants to build universities and it wants to build libraries. You can see that happening in the Gulf now in Abu Dhabi. So I think it's misleading to say it's just the West promoting an imperialism. Actually, Abu Dhabi, as it builds its own Islamic museum, within a couple of years will be sending their material to us. And China, incidentally, is building 100 Confucian centres. And hopefully some of those will come here to promote Chinese culture. Maybe that may be in a communist way, but I'm not sure it's all bad. We will learn more about China as a result, and I don't think that's really a bad thing.
Okay, thanks, Stephen.
You asked for a one-liner. Memo to self, quit flirting with politics, stick to art.
Yeah. There you go.